Group meeting, Saturday, 12th September, 1981. I thought it might be useful if today we considered what is called meditation in the Western world. And the Western world of recent years has taken to meditation in a big way, forgetting that the ordinary definition of the word meditation in the West, at least the English word meditation, is musing. Now, musing has nothing whatsoever to do with meditation. It's just a rambling about of the activity of the brain. It is silent chatter, the very thing that has to disappear altogether before meditation in its reality can come into being. I am compelled to use the word meditation because there is no other word which adequately expresses the full meaning of the Sanskrit and Pali samadhi. It may be useful to regard samadhi not as sometimes translated, in fact all too often translated as concentration. The capacity to concentrate and the actual act of concentration plays its part, if you like, in meditation, but it is on the whole not too significant a part. Concentration is an intensifier. And as far as intensification of true meditation is concerned, concentration is valuable. But concentration is also an excluder. And you see, in the real samadhi, there is no such thing as exclusion. There is, in actual fact, total inclusiveness. An inclusiveness so total that you cannot separate the parts which constitute that total inclusiveness. It is an integration of all that we are conscious of in terms of separation and isolativeness. It's an integration of all that. And the word integration naturally is, and or if it is not, it should be associated with livingness. With mechanical things, you have synthesis. You put the parts together, you can just as easily put them apart. Take a watch, put all the parts apart, or take a car and put all the parts, apart. You can just screw them up together again and make what we call a whole watch or a whole car. You see? But when the wholeness is the result of integration, then you cannot take the parts away from each other. Supposing you try to take away the liver and the or the heart or the kidneys or the brain and put it aside for a little rest for the weekend or something, what would happen? In some cases, it might be quite useful to the world as a whole. But otherwise not, you see. So integration is this always spells growth, it spells livingness, it spells all that kind of change which brings to fruition and to fulfillment. So we must look at it from that point of view. It's that kind of total inclusiveness which is implied in the word samadhi, sang adhi. Adhi means the topmost, the supreme, and sang together. The supreme togetherness, the total oneness realized, the aloneness realized, the one only, meaning the one only, the totality. Now, we must recall certain aspects of all this. You remember I have talked time and again about the primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy, which is the ultimate reality, and that it exercises its creative action in the first instance in eternity, not in time and space. Time and space emerge out of that action, creative action in eternity. Again, we must bear in mind that this primordial creative energy is identical with pure or absolute consciousness. There is no difference between the two. There are two different ways of talking of the one total ultimate reality. As far as human beings can talk at all and put in conceptual terms, this is the way we have to look at things. When the Big Bang comes into operation, then this energy differentiates. Remember, it starts as the undifferentiated energy. The energy differentiates, and simultaneously the consciousness proliferates, and grades of being come into existence. Of these grades of being, which are all archetypal forms of the ultimate reality, that is to say, the creative energy and the pure consciousness, one such grade is what we may term mind, mind in its wholeness, in its absoluteness as such. And this mind is that type of creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. These are not, don't treat this purely conceptually and try to make a watertight or a foolproof logical conceptual structure out of it, because there will always be unanswerable questions involved in it. But try and sense it if it is possible, which sensing this is part of a meditative process actually. Another such archetypal expression apart from mind is what I would like to call primordial matter. Mind, primordial matter. Now this matter is something which modern science has entered into and is practically touching. In the theory of the Big Bang, for instance, it is said that that all the matter that we see in the whole universe, including all the galaxies and the clusters of galaxies and so forth, and that means something absolutely tremendous. If you put it down in figures, your mind will boggle at the size of those figures. Now, all that at its initial point, which they call the singularity, was just about the size of a pinpoint. Now, can you picture that? This total universe which we see, it is the size of a pinpoint to start with. And calculations exist which show the extraordinary density of that pinpoint. its density was 10 to the power 90, one with 90 noughts beside it, kilograms per cubic centimeter. Now, the atmospheric pressure which our bodies bear on the surface of the Earth is a mere 14 pounds per square inch. That is all the atmospheric pressure that our bodies bear. Now, 10 to the power 90 kilograms per cubic centimeter is something inconceivable by our brains. However, that is what the calculations reveal. And the temperature existing at the moment of the Big Bang has been estimated at 10 to the power 41 degrees on the Kelvin scale, which is more or less the centigrade scale. It is the centigrade scale plus 273 degrees. The Kelvin scale starts at minus 273. You see? All right. Such was the situation. Perhaps we may call that initial point when the whole universe bursts into existence, as it has been called, the singularity by the scientists, the singularity. And this, because of the intensity of the pressure and the tremendous temperature, it just burst. It's a good thing you and I weren't there. Well, it burst, and the universe came into being. Now, we can look at it metaphysically as the coming into different grades of existence of the primordial creative energy and the pure and absolute consciousness. Scientists do understand nowadays that consciousness seems to play a part. This is how they put it. It seems to play a part in all that happens in the universe and in all their experiments. That the scientist is not merely an observer, but he is a participator in the experiment in the most remarkable way. Now, these are very important things to bear in mind. So this is how things have come into being. Now, with the emergence of grade after grade of being, increasing concretization took place. When we talk of that all the matter of the universe was concentrated in a single pinpoint, you mustn't imagine that pinpoint as a particle, as a solid, something which you could hold. It is pure energy existing at such tremendous pressures and at such tremendous temperatures that there was no possibility but to explode out and produce a cosmos. Now, what shaped the cosmos is what, from in the religious context, we might call mind. That is mind. And mind and consciousness are universals. They are not particulars, meaning thereby that we cannot say my mind and my consciousness. There is no such thing. You and I haven't got a mind. There is psyche, yes, but not my mind. My psyche is an actuality. And psyche comes into being through the interaction of mind, this archetypal form of the creative energy, interacting with corporeality, the body. And because this is the apparatus, because the body is structured as it is, therefore there emerges as a result of that interaction of the archetypal energy, mind, with the body, rooted in the physical brain and nerves, the whole of the nervous system, the ductus glands, the sense organs, the streaming of the blood, and all the life activities of what we see as regards ourselves as so many persons, psychophysical organisms who are self-conscious and are existential beings. Do remember that we are existential beings. We are in the sphere of mortality. Now, this absolute pure consciousness is of a nature which has no relationship to what we call knowing or knowledge. The brain cannot produce concepts or words which could express that pure consciousness. Pure consciousness is actual being. Your very being is pure consciousness. When you walk or run, or when your body works healthily and you, as we commonly say, you are unconscious of it, which is the fact, you see. This is consciousness in its supreme sense, actually manifesting, actually functioning. you know how the Upanishads put it, Brahman is Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat being manifestation, Chit perfect attentiveness, I like to translate it as, rather than just consciousness, because the word consciousness has its different meanings in different languages and different cultures and so forth. It's being and consciousness as a unity, not as two different things screwed up together. Not at all. They are an identity. So now, this consciousness in its own transcendent reality is something which has no such element as knowing in our sense of the word knowing. How do we come to know? Physically, we have five senses. Through these five senses, stimuli enter the organism, go to the brain. The brain registers them, synthesizes these impressions, and by the use of speech, produces meaning, what we call meaningful patterns, which enable us to live our ordinary psychophysical life, our mortal, finite, existential life. You see? But this absolute pure consciousness, as I've just suggested, is absolute being, and it has no such thing as our type of knowing. We know through the sense avenues. All our thinking, all our thought process and so forth, is the result of our sensuous, meaning taking all the five senses, of our sensuous experience. Minus our sensuous experience, we would not know anything. Our sensuous experience plus the activity of the brain in synthesizing these impressions and so forth, and producing a sort of a meaningful pattern which serves our purpose here. That is our type of knowing. But with pure consciousness, it's something utterly indescribable. It is when you yourself enter and actually experience the Unio Mystica, as the Christian mystics put it, when you are in what the Buddhists call the cessation, what the Hindus call the Turiya state of consciousness, you see, then you are in that state of consciousness, and you know that all you can say about it when you come back to ordinary sense brain consciousness, all you can say about it is, it is not this, it is not this, it is not anything and everything that you can talk about in the ordinary everyday world. It completely transcends all that. It is beyond, it is nondescript, but it is the actual living fact. It is the ultimate reality itself. So, meditation, samadhi, is in actual, in reality, the movement, by movement signifying activity. Activity of a nature that I don't know. And I don't suppose anybody can sort of speak about it in a knowing way. It is the movement of consciousness in its own transcendent sphere. That is the meditative state, in the full sense of the word. Otherwise, if we merely muse and think about this and have some bright ideas come up and so forth, don't think that that is the meditative state. We are just playing about in the finite mortal sphere of just so many thoughts and feelings, our psychical life, in fact. Is that clear, or has it made confusion worse confounded? See, this is how it is. This is the true meditation. This is the true meditative state. You cannot work in order to gain it. There is no such thing as gaining that state, or gaining heaven, or gaining nirvana. Why? Because that state has absolutely no element of selfness. No element of selfness in the separative sense, in the isolative separative sense. It is the total, the absolute reality. It is, there's a very good English word for it. It is the aseity. A-S-E-I-T-Y. The aseity. You see, the absolute isness, the Ishtikait of Eckhart, and so forth. You see? Now, you can't work towards it, because if you think you can work towards it, it will imply that that absolute isness is an objective goal somewhere in the distance. But it is not in the distance. It completely includes all of us and everything. You see, you can't swim towards it or fly towards it or do anything about it at all. How then does the realization in innermost, in the deep meditative state, come into being? We, as we are the embodiment of the absolute consciousness and of the primordial creative energy. We are the embodiment of it altogether. But this particular form, archetypal form of the creative energy, mind, which interacted with body and gave rise to psyche, and therefore our nervous sensitivities and our brain capacity, the capacity of our brain to organize these impressions which we receive from the outer world, and make a life of our own, as we call it here. This has unfortunately separated us from the awareness of totality. So we are awareness of existence in terms of separate objects and of different persons. We are aware, in fact, of otherness all the time, and not in terms of the unitary wholeness of the universe. It is in that sense, really, that we can give a meaning to the Catholic saying that we are born in sin, and we are born in terms of separateness from the totality. We have denied our parentage. We are literally the children of the divine. We are actually the children of the divine. But the type of activity that goes on in our own brain and in our own psychical life and so on is of such a nature that it separates us from that supreme awareness of the totality, the utter oneness with it. This is our problem. And this activity belongs to the psyche. The psyche is the enjoyer of pleasure, the sufferer of pain, and so on, you see. It is the instrument which separates us from the totality. But it is also the crucible of all that experience and all that mode of perception, ultimately, which enables us to regain our total unity with the totality. Within us, there is a bridge. A bridge that enables us to cross over to the other shore, enables us to leave, to be free, free ourselves from the limitations and the evil and the suffering imposed upon us by our separateness and our isolativeness. We cross over that to the other shore. And when we are at the other shore, we realize it is not an other. It completely includes and subsumes all this which is the finite and the mortal. This is one of the deep meanings, if you like, of the grace and the mercy of God. This is the very grace of God itself. See, God itself, I said. It's rather interesting. If this were not the case, there would be no possibility of any redemption for us, of any full or any meaningful fulfillment in our being human beings. This we have to realize very clearly. So we step out into the unknown by crossing over this bridge. This bridge in Zarathustrian teaching, in the Gathas of Zarathustra, has been called the Chinvat Peretu. Chinvat Peretu. And it means the bridge of the separator, or the bridge of discriminative choice between good and evil. Now, to understand that quite clearly, one would have to go somewhat extensively into Zarathustrian teachings on this matter, but we haven't time for that today. We might do it some other time. But that is what the Chinvat Peretu means, you see. Now, simple terms, it means for us a shaking ourselves free of all separative selfness. And it's an extremely difficult thing to do. Consider in the first instance, why people seek to meditate. Why do they want to meditate? Not only in the Western world, but all over the world. Why do they take up meditation? Just as why do they turn to religion? Because I, the person who am suffering, who am conscious of my own ignorance and foolishness and all that, and making a mess of life, I want to find peace and fulfillment and all the rest of it. This miserable separative I consciousness is there right at the beginning. So you go to a meditation teacher expecting that, oh yes, now he will teach me how to have a good time and be happy. Which is all utter nonsense. Just utter nonsense. One goes with a selfish motive for one's own sake, and one brings out a specious argument that, oh, if I get right, which has some truth in it, remember, if I get right, then I can start putting the world to rights. I can never put the world to rights, because every single object and person in the world is an individual thing, and there is a sacred inner core to it, an adytum, the sacred place which one can never invade. So, how do you affect the world? If you are the perfected Holy One, that radiates out an invisible, intangible power which brings about its own results. This is divinity at work, if you like. You see? And this works in eternity, not in time, nor in timelessness. It is a state of utter bliss, where one may say that eternity hears its own silence. It's a state of utter bliss because it is utterly devoid of all selfness. And being utterly devoid of selfness, it is in that perfect silence which includes all the music of existence and creation and being. Now these are not easy things to see, to realize. But something like this is the actual situation, and something like this has to take place in order to come to fulfillment. Now, one may ask, you see, we get free of our selfness somewhat like this. You know that the snake sloughs off its skin. The butterfly emerges out of the chrysalis. and the liberated human becoming free of all consciousness of otherness is the perfected Holy One. It's like that. And that is our destiny, to be the perfected Holy One. And questions will be asked, but good heavens, does everyone have to attain that? No one has to attain that. You see, this is the marvel of existence. We existential mortal beings are free to choose. We are free to choose. If we make the wrong choice, the existential being, the psychophysical person, will inevitably die. If we choose rightly, then again the existential person, the psychophysical being, will inevitably die. But there is a difference between the two deaths. There is a great difference between the two deaths. It's like the difference between the sear leaf which has fallen in the autumn and the fruit of that tree. See, it's not easy to see, and it's a very austere and a very severe outlook altogether. Whatever happens to me matters not a scrap to the totality. The love of God, if you like to put it in theistic terms, if you want to be free of sentimentality, the love of God is expressed in the fact that God in His fullness and His wholeness is embodied in you, the finite mortal. And the marvel of our existence lies here, that if I or you, the finite mortal, can realize through your own good sense and activity the state of the perfected Holy One, then God has found fulfillment through you as the perfect man. Consider that Christian phrase, and the manhood was taken up into the Godhead. You don't achieve. It is the totality which achieves, if you like. The totality doesn't consider that it is achieving anything. It just does. That's how it goes on. We have to, if we mean business in our modern world, with our modern situation and knowledge and all the rest of it, if we want this to be effective, we have to realize this in the modern way. And the modern way is one in which this element of totalitarianism has to come in. It has to be an absolute realization. There is nothing for me, the existential being. Nothing whatsoever. It's the totality which reaps. I may participate in the sowing. It is the transcendent which reaps the full benefit of that sowing. So we must not look for anything for ourselves. Then you may ask, well, why do we try to find a way and tread the path? Because what is the option? What else is there to do? What else we do produces the XYZ mess of the modern world. Isn't it? Look at the modern world today. And let us not only look outside at a Hitler or a Stalin or a Mr. Tony Benn or anybody else, you see. Let us look at our own selves. To what extent am I fulfilling the divine purpose of my existence? That divinity, that totality, which took all the trouble through 20,000 million years in order to give rise to little me. And I'll be here only 70 years. Well, no, I'm already 79. I'll be here only a few more years and I'll be gone. Like the autumn leaf which just falls to the ground, that is our end as existential beings. Nothing else. Be quite certain of that. If you can be certain of that, you will find an extraordinary freedom come within your own mind and heart. a wonderful freedom from all sorts of illusions and delusions with which we have been plagued, with which we continue to plague ourselves and plague the society in which we live. You'll find yourselves utterly free of that. And there'll be an inner ananda. That's such a lovely word in Sanskrit, which we may translate as bliss. An inward bliss which is utterly beyond all understanding. That peace of God which passes all understanding, as put in the West. You see, we'll find that. It will be there. Not that we will find it, but it will inevitably be there. Just as if when you are a little child, you are perfectly healthy, then somehow you are quite happy and laughing and dancing and running and enjoying yourself and giving much pleasure to your parents and friends and so forth and so forth. Naturally, why? You are healthy. You are whole. You are holy. And therefore, all these other wonderful things are there. Wonderful to the onlooker who hasn't got them. So you see, it is like that. And it is an extraordinary thing, really, to begin to see that. And far more extraordinary to put it into practice in everyday life. Now, one other thing, there are so many other things, but one important other thing we must remember. Mind and consciousness are universals, they are not particulars. That is why I say, we must never talk of my mind and my consciousness. My psyche, yes. And you may talk like this, I am conscious of. You see, but what consciousness is, no. Don't bring that. Consciousness is identical with the primordial creative energy. That is pure consciousness, absolute consciousness. See? Now, mind and consciousness are universals. Now, the extraordinary thing about universals is this. They function wholly and completely through you all the time. You might say, but I'm very unaware of their functioning. And so forth. Of course we are unaware. Why are we unaware? Because the psyche in its present muddled up state dominates us. The psyche suffers from both its natural evolution through nature, through the animal drives in us and so forth, the fear, the aggressiveness, the drive to perpetuate the species and so forth, and so the pleasure drive and all the rest of it. All that, it's the psyche suffers from the effects of that and what we have inherited in terms of our socio-cultural heritage, which comes to us basically and in largest quantity from all our predecessors and all our ancestry and so forth. Our socio-cultural heritage that exercises a prodigious influence upon us. And it is very, very difficult to disentangle ourselves from all the follies and snares which are involved in this socio-cultural heritage. You see, this is what is handed down to me by my fathers, and I have to be true to my race. All right, I have to be true to my race. At the expense of being untrue to God, to the totality, to reality, to the fact as the fact. What am I going to be true to? What am I going to be faithful to? You see, that we have to remember all the time. So now, these universals do function through us all the time. The psyche, the existential being, obstructs this functioning of the universals by its set of beliefs, convictions, doctrines, dogmas. What I am saying now, supposing it were true for the time being, for a short period of time for certain people, will be untrue and an obstruction for later generations. So you must not grasp at it. You must let it go. Utilize it whilst the need is there, and then let it go. You see? It's like that. But we cling to all the fossilized, crystallized, verbalized concepts and doctrines and dogmas and so forth. We cling to all that and thereby succeed in not being alive in the real sense. To be alive in the real sense means constantly to grow. And growth absolutely demands the dying to the actual state now present. If, for instance, supposing this body is still growing, we'll say, that means it is still changing. Now, that change cannot take place if the present state is going to remain stay put, can it? So there's no growth. Now, this is, with the body, it comes more or less to an end by the time we are in our 20s or 30 at the latest, I suppose. But with the psyche, there is no time limit. You can go on right up to 1 minute to midnight and after, where the psyche is concerned. When the body dies, when the physical body gives out, the psyche also is completely obliterated. People who believe in karma and so forth will ask, then what about all the karmic results? The totality reaps the karmic results of what you do or think or feel or speak. You reap part of it. Not one of us is the sole agent of anything whatsoever. There are so many other factors involved with us. For every single thought and feeling, for every single word and deed. We must be quite clear about this. And we can't apportion out the karma of this person or that person. That's all utter nonsense. How are you going to apportion it out? The Lord God doesn't decide. Divine justice works this way. It is not concerned with rewarding what we call good or punishing what we call evil. It is concerned with releasing the harmony of the whole, not just you or me. This is how divine justice works. Plato put that idea out, not too skillfully in some ways, but he did. In the Republic you'll find it. And Aristotle put it in very good terms when he said that justice is the practice of virtue towards others. He put it in rational terms. That's a very good way of putting it. And you know what Jesus said on the Sermon on the Mount and what the Buddha said as presented in the Kakchupama Sutta, the parable of the saw, as it is called. It's in the first volume of the Majjhima. Whatsoever another person does to me, I must never let my mind, my psyche be perverted or feel enmity or any such thing like that. And so forth, you see. So now, this psyche is the thing that has to undergo transformation. And you'll ask, how do I transform the psyche? Our instrument of salvation is our power of attentiveness. And attentiveness is one of the supreme manifestations of divinity itself. This, in this Sat-Chit Ananda, the chit is this constant attentiveness. In the Bible it is put in these terms, not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. Now you try and think of it literally, and you laugh it out of existence. You laugh to scorn over a statement like that. Has the Father in heaven nothing else to do but to keep a record of all the sparrows that fall to the ground? Doesn't mean that literally at all, but it has a profound meaning if you understand it. You see, that consciousness takes in everything, and in the very nature of things, it works itself out. So, divine justice means just that, and you will see therefore that it is inextricably interlinked with perfect love and with perfect wisdom. The two have to be there together. So now, the practice of mindfulness, this power of attentiveness which we have, this constant mindfulness of every thought, feeling, word and deed, all through the day, this is the thing that enables us to see the truth of things gradually. The practice of mindfulness must be free of any pronouncement of praise or censure, blame or the idea of a reward or anything like that. It must be free of all our imposed, of all the values, judgments and so on which have been imposed upon us. When it is that type of mindfulness, then at last we become clear-sighted.
And when at last the psyche is completely purified, transcendence functions freely through us, and that is the meditative state.